Hey there, Dave here, and a couple of announcements before this episode about Baldur's Gate 3. First of all, this episode, the recording was so long, it was over 4 hours of recording, that I decided to split this up into two episodes. So, this first part here, this is the full non-spoiler section. There are no spoilers at all in this part. The spoiler discussion has been turned into its own episode, released at the same time, so you should see it. But in case you don't, you can go look for it on the feed. It is right there. It will say Baldur's Gate 3 spoiler section. Go check that out. Also, in case you are listening to this during the week of release, we are holding a charity streaming event in honor and memory of a community member and friend that we lost. We are doing a streaming event over on Twitch to benefit Suicide Awareness Voices of Education. If you are able, we would much appreciate hanging out in our streams, donating. You can find a donation link down in the show notes, or at the very least, sharing the event. You can head on over to my Twitter page, at RealDaveJackson, or the Fireheart Media Twitter page, that's at Fireheart_media, to see the stream schedule. I will be streaming on Friday, April 26th, from 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time. I'll be streaming Faith, the Unholy Trinity, which is one of our lost friend Chris's games that he played on his streams. Come hang out, celebrate his memory, help a good cause. We would much appreciate that. And that leaves me just to thank the wonderful patrons who support the show. So, a big shout out to Chris Nelson, the Top 3 Podcast crew, Chris Copleen, Rick Firestone, Nick Ficori, Jill, Jeff, formerly Jerf, Kieran, Soccer, ZNA, Cupcake, Kyle, Christian S., Matt, aka Stormageddon, JD, Doug Leaf, Jason Emery, Brian Skirsha, Randall, Jake Martin, Jenny E., and many more. This has been a lot of announcements, but thank you all for the support. I hope to see everybody in those charity streams. And with all that being said, let's get on to Baldur's Gate 3. Hello, everybody. My name is Dave Jackson, and you're listening to Tales from the Backlog. This is a video games review podcast where each week I'm joined by a guest to bring a game out of the backlog, play it, and discuss. If you hear a little bit of funk in my voice today, it's because I'm still coming down from that week after PAX East here. So this episode is unofficially sponsored by Theraflu. I'm ready to get this going. This is my Michael Jordan 1997 flu game episode of the podcast. We got to make it happen because we got good guests today and a good game. So the guests are friends of the show, and together, along with my dog Rookie here, we make up the best traveling party in the Forgotten Realms. First up, we have a friend of the show, Jim Rodeman. Jim, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And we're also joined by another friend of the show. We're all friends of the show, Chris Redig. Chris, good to talk with you again, man.
Yeah, good to be here.
Long-time listeners of the show may recognize the two voices here. Jim was on past episodes of the show about Hollow Knight, about Hades. We did a tier ranking of the Elden Ring bosses, and we also talked about how Super Smash Bros. Introduced us to different games and characters. And Chris was on the Vampire Survivors episode, in which we famously said, we don't think the game will change that much. And that was like 2 years ago, and the game is unrecognizable now.
Is it really? I haven't followed up
with it, but I see screenshots from time to time, and I'm like, what the fuck is happening in there? So,
I guess that's the next game, yeah?
Yeah, good to have the both of you back. Today, we're going to talk about Baldur's Gate 3, which is an RPG developed and published by Larian Studios for PC, PS5, and Xbox Series in 2023. And this is a big episode, long time in the making. For us, we had another guest that was going to join us, but he fell down a pit and died instantly. So, not here today.
The Underdark's a bitch.
I don't have any scrolls of Revivify, sorry.
No, I can't spare one. I need that for myself later on.
I used it all on Dave because he died all the fucking time.
Exactly. Past episodes on the show about Baldur's Gate, I did Baldur's Gate 1 in episode 79. That was with Phil from Deleted Saves. And I did Baldur's Gate 2. That was in episode 82. And that was with Brian from Pixelated Playgrounds. If you want to go back and listen to the experience of the first two Baldur's Gate games that I played. If this is your first time listening to the show, thank you for stopping by. And this is how spoilers work on this show. We're going to go quite a while in this episode with no spoilers. And then there will be a clearly defined place where we're going to say, hey, after this music break, spoilers start. So you can get out if you don't want to be spoiled on Baldur's Gate 3. But until then, we will save story spoilers for that section. You can also look down in the show notes. There will be a timestamp for when the spoilers begin. So let's get started. What is Baldur's Gate 3? We have prepared some elevator pitches here. I say Baldur's Gate 3 is a Dungeons & Dragons simulator, for real, where you live with the consequences of the chaos you create. What would you guys say?
Yeah, so mine is very close. I say play Dungeons & Dragons 5th edition translated into video game format without all the dice rolls, math, or spreadsheets.
Plenty of dice rolls, but only the real sickos need the spreadsheets in this game. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I guess this is a game where if you install it, then you will basically sign away the next couple months of your life and your sanity and your thoughts, because it will just pretty much take everything over. I know that doesn't describe the game at all, but that's what happens.
It is what happened. And kind of along those lines, we can talk about how long the playthroughs take in Baldur's Gate 3. My playthrough, I played on PC, it took me 103 hours, and that is one playthrough. And yeah, there were certain points, especially like the first couple weeks when it came out, when I was playing this like 4, 6, 8 hours a day, because it's just hard to stop. But I feel like I'm going to be topped by Jim here. So Jim, tell us how long you've played this.
So this is a horrifying number, and it has to be larger than this. So I've played this game since it came out for a combined total of 483 hours on Steam. However, I am currently playing a co-op playthrough where we are just running the two of us on honor mode with a friend on his PS5. Okay. And we have had to restart that twice due to TPKing. So it has to be above 500. I don't know how much.
Yeah. Jesus.
That's wild.
Yeah. It's incredible.
Chris, how about you?
Yeah, on Steam, I'm showing 211 hours. I know some of that's probably AFK hours as well. But yeah, I'd say probably 200 hours. Easy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Beefy game. This is, and like my playthrough, the one where it's like I played through it one time, start to finish. I did not restart and re-roll a new character. It just, the game took me 103 hours. I was pretty thorough with doing side quests and like exploring as much of the map as I could. But yeah, I mean, I feel like 100 hours is basically guaranteed here. So let us move into talking about our histories with the game, with the Baldur's Gate series, if we played it before, maybe D&D, because I know some of us have D&D experience here. So what brought us to Baldur's Gate 3 in the first place? So, Chris, I'll kick this to you first.
Yeah, you're saying, yeah, kind of knowing D&D before. I don't have any D&D experience really, or very little. So jumping into this game was, I think I mentioned it earlier, like, kind of felt like this first run through was the tutorial. Like still learning things about the game mechanics and things like that, even in up until the last, like, sequence of events. Yeah, I'd say like you don't have to know D&D to get into it. I think it's pretty, there's a lot of intuitive things, but I think going into a second run, knowing the game, I'll definitely be able to get through it, not only quicker, but just more efficiently and like know what's going on. So,
right.
Yeah.
What was it that like made you want to play this in the first place if it wasn't that D&D background?
I just had some other gaming friends that were getting really excited about it, and they were just like, yeah, just buy it, just buy it, just buy it. So we're probably going to play it for, you know, forever. So I did. And I have no regrets. It was amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. Props to you for actually buying the games that your friends plead you to buy. Aaron's been pleading for me to buy several games now for a while. And I'm just like, yeah, maybe sometime. Definitely sometime I'll do it. Okay, Jim, how about you? D&D history, and then what brought you to Baldur's Gate 3?
Yeah, so coming at it from a little bit of a different angle, but in all honesty, there is some similarities. So I have, before this, I had no idea who Larian Studios like were in the biz, no idea about their previous ventures. I knew that Baldur's Gate 1 and 2 existed because those are famous, even among just straight up Dungeons and Dragons players. I think they are considered canon within Wizards of the Coast. So I knew those existed, never played them. I came to this game from the D&D angle. I started playing D&D when I was a young teenager. I have 20 plus years experience. Just a quick shout out. 1 week ago, I wrapped up a 4-year campaign where I was a dungeon master.
Ooh, wow.
It was a very D&D end, and we'll get into like maybe what is D&D later, because the PCs were at the finish line. They had 3 rooms to go before the final boss, and a wish spell went horribly wrong and they TPK'd. That was the end of the campaign. 4 years down the drain. Started during COVID. I, too, like you, Chris, my players were actually talking about the game when it came out, and there was enough interest in there generated for me that it was a day one purchase, and from the penis simulator on, I was just head over heels in love.
There we go. For me personally, the only time I've ever played D&D was over at Jim's house, like one time, like 10 years ago. And, we did one session, we created our characters and played for like a half hour before everyone had to go home. And then I never played again. I moved overseas like a week later. So, I don't have D&D experience. All of my D&D experience comes from video games. I've played Baldur's Gate 1 and 2. But those are old versions of D&D. So I'm not sure that I actually have experience with 5th edition like this game is. But what I did have was I played both of the Divinity Original Sin games, which Larian also made, and those kind of put them on the map in a big... They've been around for a long time, but those really put them on the map. And I think the quality of those games helped them get the license for Baldur's Gate to make this game. So I wasn't excited about Baldur's Gate 3 in particular. Like, I know a lot of people lost their mind when it got announced, but I was excited for the next Larian RPG because Divinity Original Sin 1 and 2 are two of the best RPGs I've ever played. So the Larian pedigree was what brought me to this game in particular.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Did you play Baldur's Gate 1 and 2 like after you heard about 3 coming out? Sort of as in preparation. Gotcha.
Yeah, okay. I played them both last year.
Oh, wow. Those are super old games.
Yeah, I played them both on the Switch. And luckily, they have an easy mode, so you can just kind of like, I don't know, walk your way through the game. So that's what I did. But I did enjoy the story and the adventuring in those. But I did play them to kind of get ready for it. And nice. We'll talk a little bit later about the connections between them. But to get into some opening thoughts here before we dive into the game itself, Baldur's Gate 3 was my game of the year for 2023 in that podcast I did, and I said a lot of things that I forget about now, so I can't reference what I said in that episode. But what I'll say now is that not only is this the best Baldur's Gate game, not only is this the best CRPG that I've ever played. It's one of my favorite genres, but this is like straight up one of the best games I think that's ever been made. And it is, the more I think about the amount of work that went into this game on Larian's part, and on the part of all the actors and all, everybody like that, this, it's like kind of a miracle that this happened. And I think that some people kind of took this game's quality the wrong way when it first released, and they freaked out. They were like, what if people expect every RPG to be like this? This seems like a real one of one type of thing. It was like this beautiful thing that came together, and it's an incredible game, one of the best games I've ever played. And now people have like started to calm down a little bit and realize that it is kind of like a shooting star or something like that. So I don't like throughout this episode, it's probably going to be a long one. I don't have a lot of like straight up criticisms of this game. I don't think there's anything this game does that's not excellent. It's really like a remarkable achievement.
Yeah. And shouldn't we, I mean, if everyone's like, oh, not every game can be like that, shouldn't you at least want your developers to shoot for the moon? I mean, you know, different games bring different things to the table. If I want a shooter, I'm not going to play Baldur's Gate 3. But shouldn't you want to create the best game for your clientele?
I think that Larian in particular we're in a kind of unique situation to make this. And I think the expectation to make the shooter version of Baldur's Gate 3 is not realistic for most people. They had the early access period where they put it out. They made a bunch of money throughout early access, probably. They're able to work through bugs and things like that in real time and get feedback and shape things the way they wanted them to be. So I think everyone who does make a game, unless it's like a, you know, shameless cash grab thing, but I think like the most studios, the people that are making decisions do want to make the best thing they can make. And the people that are working on the games definitely want to make the best thing that they can. But this seems like such a singular achievement in not only game design, but pulling off all of the ideas that they had. It's like ridiculously good.
Mm-hmm. It's
the
stunning.
Fun thing about it too is like it came out at a time I recall last year, and it's the sort of discussion around this has been going on for a while, but it's like the whole discussion of like, oh, like EA being like super, you know, scummy about how they monetize all these different like gacha games. So I play WoW on and off, which is I've been playing WoW Classic with some of my old friends that I used to play WoW with all the time. And they're the ones who got me into Baldur's Gate. And so, you know, that's another game where they have like microtransactions and all this stuff. So there's always been this conversation going on for a long time about like, oh, what are good ethical monetization practices or like things like that from gaming studios. And then you have this masterpiece come out that is just a one-time payment, no BS, no anything like that. And I think it was just like, they didn't even say anything about it. Like Larian, no one at the Larian team said like, hey, we're going to do this thing because we're devout and we're, you know, we're righteous and good people. They're just like, hey, here's a game, by the way, like you can buy it and play it.
Yeah. And it's only kind of after the fact now, like the studio head did a talk at GDC and kind of talked about just like, this is the way, like, to the best of your ability, like the way to get people to buy your game and, you know, break sales records and things like that is to just make a really fucking good game and people will respond to that. And you're right. Like Baldur's Gate 3 came out and it was kind of like an arrow piercing through all of these different like discourses about games, about how people are chasing games as a service money. People are chasing like the microtransaction money. And then on the other hand, like people are saying like these single player games, they don't sell and turn-based combat is dead and all of these other discourses in Baldur's Gate just like smash through all of them because it's just really fucking good.
It also stood out in a field of standouts. Like 2023 was no slouch for game. Like they're,
dude,
you know,
beat Zelda.
It was hot on the heels of Zelda too. Like I remember finishing, like racing to finish Tears of the Kingdom, because it's like the moment I start Baldur's Gate 3, I'm never coming back to this.
Yeah. I have not gone back to Tears of the Kingdom, by the way. I put it down. Not that I don't like the game, but yeah, like Baldur's Gate came out and I was like, oh, well, I'll get back to Tears of the Kingdom sometime. Mm-hmm. I still haven't gone back 103 hours of Baldur's Gate 3 later.
Yeah.
So let us take a little music break now before we get too deep in the weeds, and let's come back, let's talk about what the story setup for Baldur's Gate 3 is. So first things first, I take it that neither of you played Baldur's Gate 1 and 2, right?
No.
I actually had Baldur's Gate a disc. I remember the cover of it and everything from when I was really little.
Okay.
Called Baldur's Gate Dark Alliance. I don't know if that, or sorry, Baldur's Gate 2 Dark Alliance. I think it was like a, maybe an expansion or the something like that for.
Oh, I think Dark Alliance is like, they're like action RPGs.
Okay, gotcha. Anyway, I remember really enjoying walking around in that game, but not having a clue what to do. I was like, right. Like 5 or 6 years old or whatever, right? It was a really long time ago. So I just recall that so much, like as being like such a good time walking around talking to people and like learning how to read essentially on that game.
Right. So the reason I ask is because, you know, whenever we have a sequel or a game in a series, the question is always, do I need to play Baldur's Gate 1 and 2 to understand 3? And the answer is pretty definitively, no, you don't. This is a separate story. It is set after the events of Baldur's Gate 2, but it's a while. So, like, the events of Baldur's Gate 2 are referenced sometimes in the story, and you may meet characters that were around, but you don't need to have played that game to understand. So that's that. Baldur's Gate 3 starts out, you create a character, and then you create what's called a Spectral Guardian character, and you'll learn all about what that Spectral Guardian is. So real quick, let's talk about some characters that we made. I made a Wood Elf Druid for my one playthrough. His name was Rolando, and I picked the Druid because Druid sounded fun. I wanted to transform into bears and stuff like that, so that was my pick.
I'll quickly try and run through all the 4 characters I've made real fast. My first one was a necromancer wizard named Levin. I chose him and played the evil way, but he was not a dark urge. He was just evil. And my goal with a wizard was to see all the spells the game had to offer, because I knew that there was going to be a lot of them, and I just wanted to see what all of them did.
Yeah.
Kind of right away. So my first character was Levin. My second was a Dark Urge halfling bard, but I played it resisting the urge as the good way. Then my third run through, I played as Lazel, and that was my honor mode run.
Okay.
And then currently I am a Dwergar, and my build is Thor. I'm just throwing a hammer and casting lightning spells.
Hell yeah.
Nice. Okay. Yeah, I guess my one playthrough, I went with a drow warlock. Not knowing anything going into the game, I just thought, oh, I like warlocks in other games, like dark magic, things like that. And right. I think warlock is a very different thing in Baldur's Gate or in the Forgotten Realms than it is to other games, which ended up being, at first being like, oh, kind of disappointed, but ended up being really, really fun. Basically being an Eldritch Blast machine gun.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Jim, real quick, can you explain what the Dark Urge is? Because when you create a character, for people who haven't played, you get to select your class, and then you get to select like a backstory. And I think, I don't remember if it's actually a class or if it's one of the backstories, but one of them is a very special thing called the Dark Urge that will like kind of dominate your playthrough. So let's get a quick thing about like what that actually is, what it means.
Yeah. So, you know, you can pick your character and you can do a number of different things. There are pre-made characters for you, or you could just make your own. The Dark Urge is a background that allows you to completely make your own character, what they look like, what class they are. However, in this Dark Urge playthrough, you have a mysterious backstory that we can get into later. And there are choices or urges, I guess I should say, that only pop up during your conversations when you are playing as the Dark Urge. The other choices are oftentimes still there, but then there are these special ones that are only for your playthrough, and they can be pretty game altering. It's very cool.
They're pretty fucked up. I started a Dark Urge playthrough and played about 5 hours of it, and I already got a taste of like we said, the urges that your character gets. And if you play into them and let them play out, some really messed up stuff happens to characters and things around the world. So that seems like a, like, I don't know if it has like a real background in D&D, or if it's like new for this game, but it's definitely something interesting that maybe if you played the game a full time and then you're like, I want to have a playthrough that goes completely differently, then like the Dark Urge will probably give you that.
That was my definitely next step. Yeah.
Yeah.
Dark Urge Monk.
Oh, you'll have a good time. It connects to things later on, and you could play it one of two ways. Like three ways, actually. You could be resisting, which is like you're trying to do the right thing. You can play into the urges and be evil, or you could play into the urges and be good and just be like someone who blacks out and wakes up and is like, what have I done?
Okay, gotcha. All right, so you create your character, and in the opening cutscene of the game, and the opening cutscene is like a beautiful CGI cutscene, beautiful in a way. You wake up aboard an Illithid vessel. Illithids are also known as mind flayers. For people who are unfamiliar, they are like humanoids with octopus tentacle heads, and they can like mind control people and stuff. And you wake up aboard one of their vessels. You've been captured. And so the opening cutscene shows the mind flayer opening up a little tank in the room, pulling out this larval parasite they call tadpoles in the game, and they put this into your character's eye. Actually, you see it happening to another character first, and then they come over and do it to your character. So that's how the game opens, in that very metal way. But that mind flayer ship is attacked, and the prisoners are kind of released. You are released. So on the ship, you meet a couple of other characters that are main named party member characters for the game. Shadowheart, who's a cleric, and Lazel, who's a Githyanki warrior, both aboard the ship. They also have the parasites, and yada, yada, yada. You fight your way off the ship. But while you're fighting your way in the ship, dragons attack the ship with these Githyanki dragon riders. It's a whole fucking thing. The ship crashes, and you have to jump off of it, and you're free-falling into the ground. Right before you go splat, a mysterious force saves you and kind of suspends you in midair to save your life. Now, that opening section when you're aboard the ship is the tutorial for the game, and it lasts about, I don't know, half hour or something like that. You meet a couple of characters, you do a combat tutorial, but all the while, like, you're right in the middle of this, like, this action. Like, you're on this ship, you've been kidnapped, you don't know what they want from you. They put this fucking thing in your eye, and then dragons attack the ship and it crashes, and it's a hell of a way to start this adventure off.
You forgot that you go through hell for like a huge portion
of
that.
You do, yeah, you snap between dimensions during that part, yeah.
What an opener. I mean, from a Baldur's Gate, from just strictly from D&D and the Forgotten Realms perspective, you have already lumped in the Forgotten Realms and the city of Baldur's Gate, the Astral Sea with the Nautiloid and the Githyanki dragon warriors. And then all of a sudden you are careening through Avernus, and there's all these demons and imps everywhere.
Yeah.
Incredible opening.
Yeah.
Yeah. It just throws you right into it. And doesn't really give you any, it doesn't really say what to do. Just, you're just in this room, and it's like, here you go, have fun. Like,
yeah,
figure it out.
Yeah. Like, so I don't have the familiarity with, like, I know what a mind flayer is, but that's about it. So like, as we're snapping between these realms and dragons are attacking, I'm like, I don't know what is going on, but the cutscene is really, really well made. So it's super entertaining and cinematic and all that. And then, yeah, you go down into this beach area around where the ship crashes, and that's where you're going to meet most of the other members of your party in the game. So Shadowheart and Lazel were on the ship with you. But you can also meet, and I don't think you have to meet all of these. I don't even think you have to meet any of them if you don't go talk to them. But there's Gale, who's a human mage. There's Will, who is a human warlock. There's Asterion, who is a human vampire rogue type character. And there's Karlak, who is a tiefling barbarian. All of them also have the parasites. What do you know? So the first kind of kick in the pants to start the adventure is you've got these parasites in your brain. They're going to turn you into mind flayers if left untreated. So the first and the big quest for a lot of the game is find somebody or something that can get these things out of your head. And you're just kind of like pushed off to explore and go find a way.
Yeah, and there's no sort of direction. I mean, you can look at your map and see like where you can go physically, but in terms of like what to do to cure this thing, like your characters are just constantly talking like, oh, we gotta cure this thing, gotta get this thing out of my head, let's cure this thing. Everyone you run into, it's like there's a dialogue option that says like, do you know anything about a healer? Can you find a healer? Like, we need to get this thing out of our head. You're just like, I have no idea even what I should be looking for. So like it really, I felt like at first it was kind of frustrating, but I feel like eventually it kind of felt like, oh, it's just encouraging you, I think, to just talk to really anyone and everything that you can.
Yeah, yeah. And like, I think you're built in, you have a couple of directions if you have these people in your party and if you talk to them. But Lazel, her people, the Githyanki, are like sworn enemies of the Mind Flayers. So she's like, okay, well, we fight these things all the time, so I know some people that might be able to help. So that's like one direction you get pushed in. But yeah, you're off at the beginning of the game just literally asking everybody like, hey, do you know a doctor? Like, is there a doctor on this airplane?
Yeah.
And some of those healers are just straight up crackpots.
I mean,
we'll talk about, can't do anything for you.
We'll talk about one in the spoiler section that ended in a very hilarious way. So those are your party members, and I want to camp out a little bit about the party members here. So again, Shadowheart, Lazel, Gale, Will, Asterion, and Karlak are the main party members. There are lots of others that you can recruit throughout the game, depending on which faction you side with, depending on your alignment, depending on what side quests you do, but those are the main ones. So I think this is one of the big strengths of Baldur's Gate 3. And this is something that like Divinity Original Sin 1 had like pretty forgettable characters. Divinity Original Sin 2 really stepped up the game there. Then Baldur's Gate 3, these side characters are like pretty wonderful across the board. Like, I didn't use all of them for the whole game, and there were a couple that just sat the bench for most of the game, but they all have really interesting backstories. The voice acting for all of them is like fucking incredible. And their like contributions into your party makeup in battle is also really interesting, like switching out people for different situations. So I'll talk a little bit more about each of these side characters, their backgrounds and stuff like that. And then let's camp out. So Shadowheart is voiced by Jennifer English. She is a follower of Shar, who is the god of darkness, I think. Right, Jim?
Yeah. She's correct. Goddess of the shadow realm.
Right. Shadowheart has lost her memories, and she's holding a mysterious artifact that everybody wants. Lazel is voiced by Devorah Wild. I hope I'm saying that right. She wants to seek help from the Mind Flayer hunters and eventually discovers something discouraging about her people. Asterion is voiced by Neil Newbon. And Asterion's a vampire. His backstory is he was dominated by an elder vampire, tortured for decades, and wants revenge. Karlak is voiced by Samantha Bayart. And Karlak worked in the Hells and had her heart replaced by what they call an infernal engine, and that engine is going to burn out soon. Gale, voiced by Tim Downey, tried to become a god by getting into a relationship with a real god. And I mean, whomst among us wouldn't? So now Gale, oops, has this magic consuming orb inside of him. He's literally a ticking time bomb. And last but not least is Will, voiced by Theo Solomon. Will has entered into a contract with a devil. Whoopsie daisy. And so, yeah, all these characters have these fucked up traumatic backstories. And if you choose to work through those backstories with all of them, if you choose to use them in combat, spend time with them, you really see how these side characters, like, they almost kind of make the game. Like, to me, the side character stories are just as important as the main story in this game. And I love all of these characters. They're incredible.
So much so that playing as those characters actually, I think, detracts from the game. I think everyone should make their own character. When I played as Lazelle, it did not nearly have quite the punch that having Lazelle as my teammate had.
Gotcha.
Oh, that's interesting.
Don't get any of their voice actors' lines because you are the silent protagonist. So completely lose out on the acting. And then you, by just making the choices, sometimes you're making choices that when you think about what that character went through in your other playthrough, you're like, this is completely illogical. Like, why would this person do this?
Yeah.
So their stories are all great. I recommend everyone make their own character. And they're all somewhat tied in together. Like, it's all kind of about, control and sort of being brainwashed, which is sort of interesting to then tie a brain tadpole into this. Mm-hmm. So a lot of these characters are going through a lot and you really feel for them.
Yeah, I can imagine, like, if you don't team up with them, or like if you just do hirelings, or if you don't flesh out their stories at all, the ending of the game might be kind of lame. Like, I don't know, when you're doing that, like the last bit, the last just before the credits roll, there's a part that if you didn't flesh out all the characters, I feel like there wouldn't be an ending. It would just be you killed the big bad, you know, cool, no one cares, like
right. Yeah, part of like the satisfaction of finishing the game for me was seeing how the character, like the side character stories, finished, because some of them had wrapped up before I took on like the final stuff, but a lot of them didn't. And the conclusion was literally after we had beat the final boss.
Right.
So waiting to see how those played out. But I really can't say enough good things about like the writing for the characters, the acting, the motion capture, all of that stuff is like, you know, when I think about my favorite NPC, like party members in video games, there's a couple from Baldur's Gate 3 that will 100% be in that conversation. Like, I didn't use Asterion a whole lot, but I love like the acting that Neil Newbon did with Asterion. I love the story that was written for Asterion. Karlach is one of my favorite video game characters in recent memory. And it's partly due to the writing, her personality, which, you know, comes from the writing and the acting. It's just like really, really good across the board. So let's just talk. Who did we use most often of this early group, we'll say, and we'll leave out the characters that you pick up later.
Well, so my first playthrough, I was the necromancer. I don't want to say things without spoiling them. I used Asterion and then two other characters that we can talk about in a minute. But Krista, you brought up hirelings. They are horrible compared to the other NPCs because they all use Wither's voice. That's it.
Yeah, true. Oh, it's kind of a weird... I only made one as like sort of an alchemy bot.
Yes.
When I figured out you could like, you know, make multiple pots, I was like, oh, I should make one of those. And then he was just really awkward and robotic, but he never left camp. So I don't know about combat or anything.
You know, you march around the world and all of a sudden you get an exclamation point above Karlach's head or something. And you talk to her and there's a scene will play out and you can interact with her. And they're just like, what do you need? You're like, oh, okay. I guess I'm never going to talk to you again.
That's right. Weird.
The side characters will also talk to each other often, which is really helpful for building out that feeling of like having a real traveling party. Like they'll comment on stuff that you do. They'll comment on stuff that the other people do. They will have little like short little exchanges when you're out traveling, when you see something. Again, like... it's part of the thing that makes this what I feel like is kind of like a singular game is the amount of dialogue and the amount of interaction that every character can have with every possible version of other characters. It's like really wild logistically how this all plays out. The main thing.
I was just going to say that's two of my characters. I ended up rolling with Lazel and Shadowheart and Asterion, but I didn't really actually like Shadowheart much from the get-go, but her interactions with Lazel made me want to keep those two together, honestly. Right. It just kind of make Shadowheart work within the mix.
Yeah, absolutely. And like Asterion's kind of a dick, and like some of the other characters will comment on that.
Yeah,
it's really good how the party works together. And I also want to shout out the voice acting for some other characters throughout the game, or notable names that are involved. And, you know, it doesn't do much good to mention their characters right now, but big shout out to the narrator. There is a dungeon master / narrator in the game talking about everything that's going on, like just a ridiculous amount of voice work. So the narrator is voiced by Amelia Tyler. Great voice, great work doing that. And then some surprise voice roles by J.K. Simmons, who I did not know was in the game until his character started talking. And I was like, holy fuck, that's J.K. Simmons. Hell yeah.
Oh, fuck. That's the voice I recognize. When he's talking, I'm like, why do I know this person? Who is this?
You know him because he's in everything.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Oh, okay, cool. That makes that character much more interesting to me for some reason. But anyway.
Yeah, for sure. Matthew Mercer does a voice role in the game. Doug Cockle, who's the voice of Geralt in The Witcher 3, has a voice role in this game. But it extends all the way down, like basically every character that you can talk to, which is most of them. All are fully voice acted, fully animated. Only like the most anonymous sideshow NPCs or like background NPCs are not voiced, and those are the characters who you'll click on and they'll just have a little text box that pops up. But like those feel like a minority of characters. If you just grouped everybody up, the amount of like voice work for all of these is really great, and it lends to a game where I want to talk to everybody. I want to see what they have to say, and the way that it's all presented, you know, with the camera angle and the voice acting and the motion capture and all of that, yeah, really encouraged me to talk to everybody, learn their stories and things like that.
Yeah, as like I was saying before, I think just from the beginning, the game kind of encourages you to do that because it doesn't really give you any direction. I mean, there might be like a map marker for a quest or something, but it doesn't give you much direction. It kind of encourages you to do that, really talk to everybody. And I thought that would be kind of a daunting task going into it. But I think like you're saying, because it is so well voice acted, every single character that you can have dialogue with, and for the most part, the dialogue options that you can respond with are really good, which I feel like that must be a very difficult task in itself, not to actually come up with, you know, a few different things that you can say for your character that have different attitudes and different outcomes and things like that. But actually to write those responses really well. There's so many times where like there's insignificant choices I have to make in dialogue. Well, they seem insignificant at least. But I still don't know which option to choose, because it's like, do I want to piss this person off, or like maybe this is gonna, you know, cause an issue, or they're gonna not like me, or they're not want to trade with me. Maybe this is somebody who trades with you if you talk to them correctly, if you choose the right dialogue options or whatever. But yeah,
when in doubt, that last dialogue option is always just attack.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
You do have that. Yeah,
you don't have to trade with them. You can just kill them and steal their shit, right?
Yeah. Part of it too is like, so if you're talking to somebody and you have choices to make, a lot of times the choices you will make will affect like how that person likes you. But one of the things that I think is like incredible about this game is how well it seems like every quest is tied in with every other quest, and like seemingly unrelated people will come up later on in the game in different quests. So like how you talk to this person here might affect their role in Act 3 70 hours later. Or like, so you do this quest that you think is just a one-off side quest, like I'm going to do it to get some treasure or to get some experience points or whatever. And then like 30 hours later, like something happens that directly ties in with that side quest. And this keeps happening throughout the game. It ties in with the main story. It ties in with the character's backstory and like the your party members' personal quest lines. The way that everything seems like it ties in with everything else makes those choices that you're making all the more interesting, because like you don't know when this is going to end. Like this might keep going forever.
It's funny too, because like each of the side characters or like the main characters that you in your party, they have a sort of a likeness meter towards you as well. And depending on how you interact with people also can affect that. You'll choose a dialogue option. Maybe you are talking to some, you know, child or something, and you say something snarky to them, and then you'll see on your screen like Asterion approves, but Shadowheart disapproves, and you're like, what the fuck? Like, and then by the end of the game, you're like chasing their like, oh, who's gonna like if I say this, like, or like, oh, can I up their approval rating of me if I talk sweetly to this person, or like, Asterion doesn't really like me much. Maybe I'll be like a dickhead, and like he'll like that response, like.
And those that affinity will like adjust certain persuasions that you have later in the game. Like if someone likes you a ton, you know, maybe we can get into this with gameplay a little bit, but like when you will have to roll dice in this game and it will call for like a skill check or whatever. So if you need to persuade them and they like you, that skill check is going to be easier than if they're like, if they don't like you.
Yeah, there's a lot of dice rolling in here. And like, of course, it's a D&D-ass RPG. So like, of course, there's going to be a lot of dice rolls. But a lot of video games, this is one thing I like about like the presentation of it, is a lot of video games will try to hide dice rolls from you. They'll happen in the background. And Baldur's Gate 3 takes you to a dedicated dice rolling screen. And you click the button to roll the D20 and it rattles around for a couple seconds. And then you get your result and you get this great like success or like this burp, 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 sad, like, you know, you rolled your, you failed.
The only gripe I have with that is when you're like in a room full of traps, just like spamming disarm trap to like get through this thing. It's just like a constant, here we go, open the screen, do the dice roll. Okay, let's sit around. Yeah, that's my only gripe with that. But other than that, like it's a very exciting button to press when it's like a big thing, especially when you try to persuade somebody in conversation and you try to deceive them. You see the dice roll. Well, at the end of the game, I had so many points in like persuasion or whatever on my main character that I didn't even think about it. Like if it was like if the dice roll needed like under 25, I was like, oh, no problem. Like, I'm not worried 36. About this at all.
Yeah, yeah. There are some high stakes skill checks and like dice rolls later in the game too. So the tension on that dice rolling screen is great. And it really, you know, there's a lot of things about this game that really come back down to the simple fact that Baldur's Gate has always been a D&D simulator. And, you know, if you're playing D&D with your friends, like rolling the dice is a big part of that. And like gathering around and cheering when you get a, you know, a natural 20 or something like that. So they really made that a focal point here to bring that into the game.
Some of the dice rolls that they do a little bit behind the screen are your survival and your perception checks. And it was always hilarious to be running around and all of a sudden all of your characters fail a survival check and you just stop. You're like, what is about to happen?
Yeah.
Right. When you see four perception checks go up and they're all failed, you're like, okay, everyone freeze. Don't fucking move. Like maybe enter turn-based mode. Like I'm really scared right now. What's going to happen?
It's hilarious. Yeah,
exactly. So back to the story here. I just wanted to get some thoughts about like the way the story is told, your thoughts about, you know, did you enjoy the, you know, the quote, the main plot? Did you enjoy the character stories more? How do we feel about this?
Well, I mean, I think this is probably, you know, the best game I've ever played. The story is great from a D&D perspective, from just a simple story that you could tell someone else perspective. It is super intricate in the choices that you have to make. I'm going to use this time to actually just make a quick like plea for anyone that is listening to this that hasn't played through it. And that is, make your first playthrough is going to be your most memorable. And so go in blind and stick to the decisions that you make. The failed dice rolls that come, the successes, yes. just roll with it, because that playthrough is going to be unique and it's going to be yours. And it is going to be so different from everyone else's that you can talk to them for hours about, you know, the different permutations, but just roll with it, because you're going to have an amazing time and nothing is going to beat that first playthrough.
Yeah. Things can go so differently that, like, we're going to go in the spoiler section. We're going to, between us, we have what, 6 playthroughs. And I bet all 6 are pretty different from each other. There is just a complex set of decisions that you're making. And there are so many important decisions that you make. Sometimes you don't know that they're important until they're 20 hours in the past. And then sometimes you have big decisions where you're like, okay, the game is going to fork here depending on what I do. But like the amount of decisions that you're making in each quest, in each character quest, at different stops along the main plot really differentiates playthroughs. So I agree that that first one is kind of going to kind of be your canon playthrough.
Yeah, you're talking about like, I think the term save scum could come up with yes. your comment, Jim. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah. you know, don't just like, oh, I didn't like that outcome, I'm going to load my last save. Or like, I know some people that I was playing with before, they'd spam the F5 button. They would just be like autos or like quick saving so often, like before and after every interaction. And that's fine. Like, play the game how you want to play it. If that's fun for you, that's great. But I kind of agree. I think the only times that I ever would like load a save, would be like, I know how I kind of want this to go, or like, I kind of know the thing that I want to say, but sometimes it's very rare that the dialogue options are kind of unclear about, I guess I want to say this because I know that this is going to happen. But then you'd get a couple options where you'd be like, there must be this outcome that I want from this, or this must be this way that I want to convince this person. And then something would go horribly wrong. I don't know if it was, mm-hmm. you know, just because I'm stupid and socially inept, or if it's because the game was just weird, or just like it, I don't know. So there would be times where I was like, I definitely want this person to be on my side. I'm going to say this because I think that's what they want to hear. And then it wouldn't be. And I'd be like, that's really weird. That's really strange. Like, yeah. So I would go back. But other than that, no, I think I totally agree. Like, roll with the punches. Like, I lost a character because I accidentally killed them, only later to find out that they could be in your party. And I was like, oh, shit, that person's badass.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm not going to like go back. Like, I made that choice. That wasn't like a, yeah, anyway.
Yeah, I think that that's like the big takeaway from the story here, because like the main plot is, it's a fun fantasy story. And I was legitimately interested in like, what is the cult of the absolute actually? What do they want? And like figuring out that stuff. And whenever you meet a new antagonist, like finding out their backstory and how to get past that obstacle and progress, all of that was interesting. But like the stuff that really sticks with me as far as like, what I would say my Baldur's Gate 3 story is those emergent things that come up, like the dice rolls that fail, the sticky situations we get into because of that, the way the character quests turned out based on decisions that either decisions that I made or decisions that that character made. Characters will leave you if they don't like you in this game. And like, there is one main character who I pissed off in the course of their character quest, and they just said, you know what, fuck you, I'm out. And I never saw them again. So yeah. Like that kind of stuff can happen. And that all plays into this emergent narrative that, like, Jim, you played a lot of D&D. Like, that's kind of the point of it. Like, the point of a D&D campaign is the stories that rise up along the way, more so than like, you know, the grand plot that you've written for the campaign, right?
Exactly. And that's not belittling this grand plot. I mean, the
no, it's good.
The,
for
the
sure.
background story is super interesting in here, intriguing. I mean, you want to figure out why is this happening to me, sort of thing. But your interactions with your party members are definitely what makes it your story.
Yeah, I think the main storyline, the main quest line, it does follow a pretty like typical. Hey, you're in the world. You have a problem. You know, talk to people or do the thing, do the quests until you find out, okay, there's this big bad, kill the big bad. Okay, now there's these three big bads you have to kill to get to this big bad, like blah, 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 that sort of a thing. What's interesting about this game is that there aren't, you know, there are choices you can make. You know, you don't necessarily have to kill this big bad. You can
right.
maybe do something else. Not to give any spoilers away. It's not like it's a linear progression that's locked into, you know, milestones along a path.
Right.
You can kind of choose how you want to deal with those milestones. This is really cool. I think in terms of just like it being kind of a typical, like there is a looming threat. You need to get to the end of the threat and kill it.
Right.
But even that's not even fair to say because there's ways to play the game where you don't, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. Like they'll give you that quest and they'll say like, okay, like, you know, this person, they're in this place, they're evil. We need you to kill them so that we can make progress through this land and get to the next place. And then you go talk to that person and yeah, they might be evil, but they've got their things going on and they might make you a deal that says, hey, I know what you really need is to get to this place. Team up with me and I'll get you there too. Like you don't have to, you know, we don't have to fight. We're not so different, you and I. And you can follow that. You can treat with them. You can kill them. You can do quests for them, but then betray them at the end. There's all manner of ways. Like there's some of those characters that like they can become party members or they can be that big bad that you killed along the way. It just depends on how you want to deal with everything. So again, the complexity of how these quests work and how it ties together. And then like, okay, so that's how you handled this quest. Now the rest of the game is going to be a little bit different because of how you did that. And it's just like constantly morphing to fit what you've done. And it's just, yeah, it's again, a logistical nightmare, I imagine, to make it all work.
Sure.
But like the finished product is just so good and memorable. That's another thing, another reason why like this is a one of one game. And I can't really expect every other RPG that comes out after this to be like, well, we got to do what Baldur's Gate 3 did.
Yeah. Didn't Larian say they're doing their own IP?
Yeah, they said they're done with Baldur's Gate. They said they're done with Baldur's Gate 3 and Baldur's Gate in general. And the next thing they do is going to be something completely unrelated.
Yeah, right. That's, I mean, you take an existing IP and make a masterpiece out of it. I think a lot of people like kind of like to what you're saying, like, oh, can we expect, you know, greatness from any other RPG like this? Well, I mean, Larian has the ability to deliver something incredible, but they're going to be starting from literally like underground, like from the thought process of like, what world are we going to create?
Yeah.
And that's going to be interesting. I'm sure probably won't be for another decade before we see anything about that. But didn't this game take like 13 years to develop or something?
I'm not sure exactly when it started, but like they were working on it for a while and then it was in early access for several years. So
yeah,
it was a big project. And my condolences to whoever takes on the feat of trying to make Baldur's Gate 4, if it's not Larian,
right.
Cause they've got a high bar to live up to.
Mm.
So let's listen to some music. Let's come back. Let's talk about aesthetics for this game. All right, so just a little section here talking about music and visual presentation. I think that the music is probably like the least remarkable thing about the game. That's not to say that it's bad, but it is very much like calm background D&D adventuring music for a lot of the game, especially when you're out in the environments, when you're in your camp. Some of the songs, like the main theme is this big boisterous triumphant song that gets like remixed and reused throughout the game. But other than that, a lot of the music is pretty laid back, chill, adventuring music. Like if you were playing tabletop and you went on YouTube and Googled like tabletop background music, and then, you know, you got a playlist. That's kind of like the tone that the soundtrack is taking here.
Yeah. And I like that a few tracks, all of a sudden they just, you'll get used to sort of the ambiance. And then all of a sudden they'll just hit you with a few tracks with singing in it.
Yeah.
But the singing
it's kind
is
of jarring.
It is, but the singing is good too. So it's just kind of wild.
Yeah. It's good. It's not overproduced. Everything sounds very just like they're using real instruments, real voices, all these things like that. It sounds really, really good.
Did either of you play with a bard a little bit and set up like a bard band?
Just my Dark Urge character is a bard, but again, I only played like a handful of hours, so I didn't get super far into that.
There's legit like six different songs that they then coded in for you to play. What? How many different instruments can you play? Five?
But there's a lot.
And if you can like just listen to them on YouTube, a full bard band, and like it's all still good music.
Nice.
That's awesome. I didn't even know that. I made Will a bard for some reason. I don't remember why, but anyway. I think I just needed like a something for a second. Anyway, I was really bad about that. I stuck with the same like three, four part. Like my party was just like Asterion, Shadowheart, Lazel the entire time. I tried to play with Will a little bit because I thought he was kind of an interesting character, but that was like really short-lived. I stuck with those three the entire game. The others had like no love until the end of like Act Two, when I was like, I kind of want to see these people's storylines a little bit. But
those songs with the vocals are good. They kind of reminded me of how like The Witcher uses songs with vocals for kind of like effect, rather than like they're singing words and you're going to listen to the lyrics or something like that. With one huge notable exception in Act 3, which we'll talk about in the spoiler section, but I busted out laughing when that song came on.
Chef's kiss.
Disney ass villain
that's
song.
That theme that keeps playing throughout pretty much the whole game. It's a good theme, so it's good that it happens that way. I also thought for a while, I was like, yeah, this is kind of getting a little like, I guess, underwhelming. When you come from other games like Final Fantasy 14, I don't know if you guys ever played it, but like every area has an amazing track to it. Every boss has like an incredible, like absolutely incredible song that goes together with a boss fight or whatever. And so, yeah, when it doesn't really change up too much, it's starting to get sort of underwhelming. But then I kind of thought about it more like there's a lot of, I mean, in those types of games, I think the music lends itself to the action and the pacing of it. But the action and pacing of Baldur's Gate 3, like there is the action, there's like the combat music that fits it perfectly. And at the same time, I find myself focusing a lot on being effective and being very efficient in combat. So I don't really need like some crazy, you know, music blasting in my face. And when I'm doing dialogue options, I don't want to be sort of distracted by the music. I kind of thought about this more, I guess, more towards Act 3, where I was just kind of like really focused on what was going on in the story and the dialogue and things. So I think it works to its benefit to not be changing it up all the time.
Yeah, for sure. One other thing about this game's presentation that I think works really well is the visual presentation. And I will say like a more cinematic presentation than CRPGs normally do. Even modern CRPGs like Disco Elysium or Divinity Original Sin or something like that. And I talked, you guys don't know this because this episode, you know, it's in the future, but I did an interview where I talked with Felipe Pepe, who wrote for and edited a big ass book called The CRPG Book. He's a CRPG expert. And we talked about why Baldur's Gate 3 appealed to mainstream more than CRPGs normally do. And one of the things we talked about was visual presentation, because this is not one of those games where you just have this big text scroll that you're reading on one side or at the bottom of the screen, and your characters are these little tiny, you know, pixelated things way off in the distance or like really far zoomed out. this takes like that camera framing from like The Witcher 3 and Mass Effect and stuff like that, and puts all these characters right up in the screen so you can see them, you can see their faces. Every single character that you can talk to in the game is voice acted and motion captured. So, and there's a lot of like different motion capture work for different characters too. So it has a more cinematic presentation than the average game like this, including, you know, Baldur's Gate 1 and 2. I mean, you maybe think of other RPGs like this, like Skyrim. There's a lot more motion capture and voice acting in this game than in Skyrim. The characters feel more alive than characters in like the Bethesda Fallout games or something like that. So that presentation helps you connect with the characters, but also like, I'm not sure why this appeals to mainstream more often, but I definitely think this is a factor because this is like a breakout hit as far as this genre is concerned.
Yeah, I would say I think people are like generally attracted to or want to see humanistic things in everything, right? Yeah. So the more that you put more humanistic element, music's kind of the same. If you have very like processed and robotic type things that go on, people maybe not know that that's what's going on, but they will prefer something that is more human to it. That's, you know, the drum hits are a little bit off, or the facial or sorry, and in music the pitch is a little bit off. So I think when you have a game like Baldur's Gate 3, where every character essentially has really sort of detailed facial expressions, they have movement when they talk, they have all these different things, that is, it's definitely way more human than like you're saying Mass Effect or something, where they kind of just stand there, you know, their faces don't really move much, their mouth moves, and they just kind of like maybe sway back and forth a little bit. Like I think that is definitely going to attract a lot of people, because they'll see in a video, oh, like look at this character that, you know, not only do they look really good, they're well designed, but they're actually having a conversation. It feels like you're having a real conversation. It feels very human almost.
Yeah.
They all have like a really good number of idle animations too. Like Lysel is always grinding her sword or hammering a piece of armor.
Yeah, Karlach is always like hopping around, you know, ready to go.
Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, a lot of the art direction is based on D&D, which was, it's not like Larian had nothing to work with. They literally walked into kind of pre-written, pre-drawn environments.
Right. Yeah.
But some of them are just so well done. I mean, the Underdark is probably one of the most like beautiful environments I've ever seen. It's just gorgeous.
Kind of along those lines too, like you're working with fantasy races and creatures and things like that. But this game is rendered in like a quote realistic type of way. Like it's not a super stylized look to the characters. They're kind of rendering them as realistic as possible. And I think that like you could have run into just things looking really goofy and like not being able to take them seriously at all. Like the Githyanki could easily look like super goofy and you just laugh at, you know, look at these like Shrek looking motherfuckers or something like that. But I think that they walk that line really well, where you have like these, you know, like the tieflings, they look like demons basically. But the way that they're designed, that's not how they feel, or they don't look goofy. There's one Githyanki character that I thought looked pretty goofy, and it's just because I don't think beards look good on that.
Those characters.
Yeah, everything else looked good. I mean, even when you're like talking to an animal or something like that, like all that presentation is really good.
Yeah. If you, like, I play on an ultra wide, and there'll be times where I'll be playing and my wife would walk in and I'll just be like, kind of like walking through Baldur's Gate or something. I'll shift my camera around and it'll be just like this massive vista of like, you know, with the docks and the ocean and the buildings and everything. She'd be like, it looks so real. Like, is this a game or a movie? Like, what's going on? It's incredible.
Yeah. One other thing too, you kind of mentioned, this game has that isometric camera perspective that CRPGs normally have, but you can freely control the camera in this game too. You can swing it around, you can have it go behind your main character, kind of like in The Witcher or you know, a regular third person game or something like that.
Did you play primarily in isometric?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I played like the whole time. Oh, you didn't? Okay.
I played it mostly at like with sort of with it behind me using the WASD keys to move it around. It took me a long time to get used to the camera. Honestly, I hated it at first. I really didn't like it at first, but yeah.
The controls of like clicking to move and then also moving the camera with the keyboard took me a minute to, not a minute, it took me literally hours to get used to.
Yeah.
But I did play with that isometric perspective for like the whole game.
Interesting. I feel like it takes away so much of the scenery and everything.
You're probably right. Like, Chris, I can't imagine trying to find anything hidden the way that you played.
Well, I mean, I would switch back and forth, you know, when I needed to. Yeah, just press the O key and it'll go up to isometric. But yeah, I just felt like the visual of it, having it kind of like, you know, behind your character in that third, I guess it would be third person, right?
Yeah.
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 I loved finding those moments where I'd be like, oh, I bet you this would be a cool view. And then zooming in to see that. And
that's
always
so funny. Our experience is like totally opposite. I only used isometric when I like felt like I needed it.
Yeah. I think it's just because, like, I don't know, I play a lot of these games, and these games, to me, like, this genre almost is an isometric camera perspective genre. But I did think it was cool that you could kind of make the camera do whatever you wanted it to do, like frame it up however you want when you're running around or when you're, you know, exploring, stuff like that. So I thought it was neat that you could, you know, do a more cinematic, like behind the character third person camera. So it's cool that you did like the whole game that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, pretty much. I mean, you guys are like moving the camera around and everything, right?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, not just rotating it, but like using your WASD to like, okay, gotcha.
Yeah, you have to like, you have to have the camera follow your characters and stuff like manually. So.
Yeah, right. Oh, true. I guess it's always kind of like that. Anyway, sorry.
Yeah. No, that's cool.
It took me a while to really get to grasp it, to get a hold of the camera and everything. But once I did, I really liked it a lot. And I found myself like going back to playing like WoW, where it's just like constantly following you. You can't really control your camera at all other than just like panning. I was like, man, this is tough. Like, I want to go see what's up there. Like, and I have to actually walk over there. Like,
mm-hmm. Well, that's where that isometric perspective is good, because when you're doing that, you see what's up there right away. A lot of rotating the camera, though.
Ton.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure.
All right, so let's talk about gameplay in Baldur's Gate 3. So this is based on 5th edition Dungeons & Dragons. We talked about this earlier in the episode, but two of us on the podcast have very little or no D&D experience. So no, you don't have to be a D&D expert. And one of the things I really love about this game and Larian's approach to making sure that people can play this game is that they make a real effort to teach you the terminology in the game, in context, right at the second when you need to know it. This game has a really smart kind of nesting UI glossary system where, let's say you pick up a scroll and you go to your inventory, you click on the scroll, it says, this is a scroll, it does this spell, and then you mouse over that spell, it will bring up another box to say what that spell does. And let's say the spell does, you know, says it puts reverberation on the target. And you're like, I don't know what the fuck reverberation means. You mouse over reverberation, it brings up another box that explains what that means. And then you can close all the boxes and you're like, all right, I get it. We're moving on. Baldur's Gate 1 and 2 did not do this at all. Not even the modern re-releases of the games that don't come with the game manual. So that's why I played those games on easy. This game, again, they took the effort, tons of writing, tons of UI work to make this as approachable and learnable as possible. And I cannot tell you how much I appreciate this, because before I bought the game, I asked some people that played it in early access because I was worried. I was like, well, if they do it like Baldur's Gate 1 and 2 did, I'm not going to understand what's going on. But they took all this effort to teach you what everything means. And there's a lot of stuff. So, like, obviously, you're going to have, you might be a little overwhelmed by terms and proper nouns and stuff like that. But they do teach you. So if you're willing to read through those nesting glossaries, you will learn what's going on. So Chris, did you have the same kind of experience as me? Because Jim's the D&D expert here.
Yeah, I kind of like quickly learned what the T button did in terms of those things like inspecting things in your inventory or whatever. I have actually just to kind of say if anybody's on the fence about buying this game, which I feel like at this point, if you have been on the fence and you didn't do it, you might not ever, but please do. Like, I've had a few friends who didn't know that you can inspect in this like UI thing. So you got to press T.
Yeah.
Hover over something, press T, go to the thing that like has an underline on it, press T. And it, that thing will just keep going until it ends and you can kind of find out what something does. I've had a couple of friends who didn't know that you could do that. And like, they didn't even know like what half of the weapons in the game did because so much info. Like you'll hover over a weapon and it'll tell you like its base damage and like maybe one of its effects, but then there'll be like a little bit more. There'll be like a little ellipses. And if you don't see that and you don't inspect it, like there could be a whole other effect that it does. And you don't even know. Like, yeah. So you have to kind of inspect everything in that way, especially as the game progresses and things get a little bit more complex and intricate. But yeah, I think that a lot of the 200 hours that I put into the game was going through those menus and making sure that I understood what things did. And it's a lot. Like, there's a lot of stuff. And I would say this doesn't really come to the game's detriment, but because you can choose whatever you want to do at any time, essentially, and you can choose whatever class you want to play, whatever spells you want to learn or whatever, there is still a lot. So like you're saying, what the fuck's reverberation? Well, it's like, what are lightning charges? What are, like, if I went lightning and you went thunder, you know, wizard or whatever, or sorcerer, like you can do any of those things. And there's nothing that tells you like, hey, you know, this is what this does. You have to just go through them and do them. And I feel like a lot of the time in that game is spent reading tooltips, but that's not a bad thing, in my opinion. It's interesting because you can start to formulate ideas about how you want to like set up your party or set up your prepared spell, set up your, you know, before you go into a fight, like, do I want to have this person in front or in the back or hiding in the corner or whatever? Yeah. So,
yeah, there's just like D&D is so complex. There's so much stuff that if you're not an expert going in, you're either going to really struggle or you're going to spend time in that menu reading about what everything does. So yeah, I definitely spent like many hours cumulatively just reading what does this status effect do? What does this word mean? So lots of stuff, but I would much rather them make this complex game with this like seemingly infinite possibility space and then have all of these things that I have to learn than either dumb it down and have it be too simple or just straight up not teach you and just assume that you either know or that you're going to play with a wiki open on another screen or something like that.
Yeah. Or like you'll go through all the tooltips and then you'll hit level 4 and be presented with your first feat. Like, what the fuck? Now I have a whole other book to read? Like, Jesus Christ. Like, there's just so many options. Yeah.
Yeah. Speaking of, the game takes you from level 1 to level 12, and it's capped at level 12 because in D&D, once you get past that point, you're basically working on like the level of gods. Mm. And Larian said they capped it there because they just couldn't program higher level stuff because it's just too complicated. So this is like the nitpickiest of nitpicks, but like I hit level 12 like 20 hours before I finished the game. So there was a bit of like, man, I wish I could get a few more level ups in just to keep that cadence of level ups going. But once I realized why they stopped it at level 12, I'm like, yeah, that makes sense because you... Like with the amount of interaction, and we'll talk about it, but the amount of interaction with your skills and spells and stuff in this game, just those god level spells just would not, like they couldn't do it, like literally could not do it. So it makes sense.
They had to limit the amount of spells that they even have for spell levels that are in the game. And yeah. And I completely understand, like, scrying, which is a spell that, think the crystal ball, like, I'm going to watch you from afar. How do you do that in a video game? Like, right. Oh, I just want to pick this random character and see how they're cooking dinner. It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
I don't think it would honestly need to go past level 12. I didn't have, honestly, maybe, and I was just playing, I wasn't playing on tactician. I was on the middle balanced mode. But
right.
By the time I was 12, and I got some help from some online stuff to, like, say, okay, I don't really want to play cleric, but I do want to have a decent build for them. So, like, I would look up a build and just kind of see what some good or better spells would be, just to know, because I don't, you know, stepping into the game not knowing anything. Mm-hmm. So there's a couple things that I, like, took and was like, yeah, let's get a good build going. But by the time I was level 12 and had some of the better pieces of gear, like, I think there's one particular boss I remember who I don't even think they even got an attack off, because I just like, at that point I was like, I had a spell that could, like, blind them. I had a spell that could paralyze them. I just had all this stuff that was, like, you know, it just kind of, it became overpowered at some point with the combination of gear and levels. So I don't think that you would ever in this game need to go past level 12. Like,
yeah, there was a point, like, maybe around, like, level 10 or so, that was, like, kind of the point where I started to get, like, some of the game's best gear and really figure out, like, my party composition and my strategy for most fights. And I really didn't struggle in combat until there were two bosses late in the game, late bosses that were real sons of bitches. I mean, like, 45 minute plus fights, like, they're real tough. But other than that, it wasn't like I need to gain levels because I'm struggling with the game or anything like that. It's just like my lizard brain is like, hey, you haven't leveled up in a while. This feels bad. So it's just that. And then, you know, like I said, it's like I had to learn, like, oh yeah, these super high level spells in D&D would literally, like, my computer would explode if they tried to, like, program the effects on the game world and stuff like that. So I get it. So in the game, you spend a lot of time exploring. So let's talk about that before we dig into combat. We talked about the camera perspective that you can switch around. Big shout out to the key you press to highlight all interactable objects in the rooms that you go in, because there's a bunch of stuff and you don't want to miss, like, a button hidden on a wall somewhere just because it didn't stick out from the environment. So that is a savior. And then there's a lot of time spent just exploring around, trying to get past obstacles in the game world. And one thing, if you're familiar with D&D, one change that they made for the game is you don't have to roll dice to do things like jumping or throwing something out of combat. Well, in combat, you don't have to roll a dice to jump, for example. They were just like, you know what? Your characters are athletic. They jump. That's all there is. That was a good touch, because there is some, I can't think of a better term than puzzle platforming to, like, figure out how to traverse this world around. So it's like, you know, you can try to jump over this, or you can try and find an alternate path. You can use teleport spells. The druid can turn into animals that can fly. You get scrolls that can do stuff to move you around. But there is a lot of, like, puzzling out, like, okay, I see a place over there. Maybe there's a treasure chest or something. How do I get there? And that was always fun to figure out.
They did a really good job of placing, however small and simple they were, just little puzzles throughout the world as well. You're always coming across a chest that might, like, you can't just lock pick open, or, you know, here's a puzzle, and if you do this, a door opens over there. There's a whole lot of just puzzle solving, and it might not always be the hardest in the world, but it definitely shakes up gameplay enough that it keeps things very interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I feel like one thing that took me a long time, I think it was probably not even till, like, late act two, that I kind of realized, like, you know what, if I can't figure this out, there's probably a tool somewhere in my inventory to help me do it. Like, I have a scroll that can, you know, give me fly, or, like you're saying, like, you know, I can throw this thing over there to make it explode, blah, 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 whatever it is. Like there's usually something in your inventory that can help you fix something. And also something that I think I underused a lot, but I would like to use more in my next playthrough is like, if you feel stuck with something because things are moving too quickly or whatever, go into turn-based mode. You can activate turn-based mode and you can like, there's a lot of things that I can look back on and just be like, man, I should have just done it that way with that, with turn-based mode. Like, I feel like I could have done this more efficiently, or I could have like saved this person or whatever it was. That's a feature that I feel like is not highlighted enough. Just being able to freely go into turn-based mode.
Yeah. Another kind of like puzzle situation that just came to mind is like, you know, maybe there's a ledge and there's a treasure chest, or like it's literally the place I need to go. I need to get up on this ledge, but I can't jump that high and I don't have a way to teleport up there. But there's some crates around and you can manipulate a bunch of objects in the environment. You can like drag them and drop them. You can pick them up and then put them places. One of my characters used this in combat to very funny effect often. But so it's like, you know, maybe I don't have these more advanced techniques. Well, you can literally just stack boxes and climb on top of them to get to this place that you can't reach either. So you do have like a pretty good set of tools outside of combat to help you reach new places, maybe help you survive if you have to reach someplace that's really far down as also. Or sometimes you just tank, like, you know, you're like, oh, jump. Everyone's going to lose 100 HP by jumping off of here, but we don't really have a choice. So it's just, you know, moving around in the game world is not really an afterthought in this game. You do have to puzzle out how you're going to get to the places you're trying to get to sometimes. And it's good fun. It works your brain in a way that the combat system really does. But outside of combat, you're also working your brain that way, too. So let's talk about that combat. It's turn-based combat, and it's real turn-based combat, the type where you can sit and think as long as you want for the move you're going to make. And depending on what difficulty you play on, you will probably want to be pretty careful about how you play. Now, Chris, you said you played on the default difficulty, like the standard or whatever.
The balanced, yeah.
Yeah, that's what I played on too. Jim's done tactician and honor mode, right?
Yeah, you can. I don't think you can do this with honor mode, but you can adjust it once you're in game from the menu. Yeah. So I started my first playthrough on normal and then very quickly bumped it up to tactician.
Okay, gotcha.
Did you play it at all on balanced?
No.
I mean, oh, okay. I was going to ask like if you could see a major difference between the two.
The game claims it's there, but I mean, honor mode, there's a huge difference.
Sure.
It's not just the single save. Like, there are bosses in the game where their legendary action is just an insta-kill. And so, like, that was very stressful.
Yeah, honor mode is super difficult difficulty and permadeath. Like, you die, you start over from the very beginning, right?
Right.
Yeah,
correct. And you get one save through. So, like, or save... file. So like if you make somebody mad and they're an enemy, you can't like F5 save scum, go back,
right?
Let's redo that. Nope, that person hates you now.
Yep. So all that to say, combat is involved unless you're playing on the easy mode. And if you want to play on easy mode, by all means, play on easy mode. I think that you should play this game however you want to, that will allow you to experience it. But the combat that we played on, like the standard and then higher difficulties, takes a lot of strategy. It's very, very tactical, we'll say. So each character, by default, can move a little bit on each turn. They can take an action, and then they can do a bonus action. And different skills can be, like, one skill will be used as a regular action, but can't be a bonus action, and vice versa. Later on, this gets more complicated as you get more skills. You can take more actions. You can do more bonus actions. Bunch of stuff that can happen. One thing that I did not love about this, and it's just a D&D thing, is the use of spell slots. So Divinity Original Sin 1 and 2 use this action point system. So you could use your spells as many times as you want if you had the action points on your turn to use them. This one has spell slots like the D&D rules. So let's say your fireball spell, you can only use it 3 times because it's a level whatever spell and you only have 3 slots for that level. So once you use that, you can't use that fireball spell again until you do a rest, either a short rest, which you can do instantly outside of combat, or a long rest that takes you back to your camp. And the system of doing this, I thought, was interesting. Like, you need camping supplies to camp and do a long rest. I thought it was interesting to like break up the adventure and kind of give you that like narrative thing where, like, yeah, your traveling party is going to have to rest sometimes. They're going to have to eat sometimes. And I had fun kind of choosing what everyone was going to eat at night. It's like, all right, 40 sausages for the entire party tonight. Or you get an achievement for doing a long rest where you only have alcohol as your food right. for the night. So since you need those supplies, I became like the most notorious snack bandit in Faerun, just stealing all the cheese and sausages and fruit that I could find everywhere. But yeah, this managing your spell slots and like managing your resting to replenish those is kind of an interesting limitation on like how you can approach combat, especially if there's a long series of fights. You need to really hold back on your most powerful stuff until you really need it. So this is probably like the biggest limiting factor on what you can do in combat. So what did you guys think about this?
I mean, it's definitely a system that is in D&D, but there's like in D&D, there's no limitation to the number of short rests you can take in a day. Whereas in this game, you only get 2 short rests per long rest.
Right.
So certain characters, they operate on either a long rest or a short rest. And like a monk or a warlock is sort of a short rest based character. So in, I think, your standard game of D&D, the fact that you can take unlimited number of short rests throughout the day makes those characters that much more viable. Whereas here, it definitely, they almost felt like, to me, when I played them, that they were the stopgap. Like when I would get to a certain point, I'd be like, all right, I took my 2 short rests. I guess it's time for a long rest. Whereas when I went with more of a long rest based party, I really felt like I could kind of go as long as I wanted. Mm-hmm. It's definitely like, it definitely put the pressure on when, before I realized that I need to pick up every apple core that I found. Because there was definitely a point in the first, like my first run through where I was like, I'm running out of camp supplies and I am like nowhere near the end of Act 2 and there's nowhere to get them. So it definitely provided a, like a nice puzzle. I found it interesting, I should say. I think that is one of the things that didn't translate over incredibly from tabletop to video.
Yeah, I think that the reason it doesn't translate like seamlessly over from tabletop to video game is you have way more combat in video games mm-hmm. than you do in a tabletop session. From like the limited tabletop, you know, between D&D and then a couple other times I've played other systems. But video games just have way more combat, so it puts more strain on your resources if they're limited in that way. Now, that being said, like I didn't find myself like screwed because I was out of spell slots that often, although it certainly happened in Act 3. Plenty of times I got in some really hairy situations because I was just out of spell slots for everybody. But yeah, it kind of like... I'll kick to you, Chris, but like it kind of felt like it put a halt on the momentum of the adventure. It's like, oh, everyone's out of stuff. We got to go do the long rest now.
Yeah. I had very opposite experience. I had so many camp supplies and it's not because I hoarded them. I think actually near the end of the game, I stopped picking them up because I just wanted to save inventory weight or whatever it's called.
Right.
Nice.
Bag space. I think I mentioned earlier, I tried to play this game very, very efficiently, especially in combat and things like that. And I had a party that was like, I had Asterion and Lazel, and they're both just, I mean, their auto attacks are some of their strongest things that they can do. And they can get more actions and things like that. They can be leveled up in a way where they don't need long rests at all, even don't really need a lot of short rests. So I also played a warlock who just benefits from short rests, but also just her cantrips are her bread and butter. Eldritch Blast is just like massive, right? So I just only had one character that was really using a lot of spell slots, and I learned to be very efficient with it. But that, I think, I realized later on acted to my detriment, because a lot of the character story stuff that happens at night when you go and end the day and do a long rest.
Yes.
And if I didn't do it often, I tried to be as efficient as possible. And that was my detriment, because I missed a lot of stuff. So nearing the end of the game, I was just like long resting just to see like, you know, like, okay, let's talk to all the quest givers. Everybody has an exclamation point above their head. And then just like basically going to bed, ending the day and just doing it again, just to like make sure I cleared everything out. Right.
Right.
But by that point, when you're already in Act Three, you know, people have like left my party.
Mm-hmm.
You can't go back and do this quest because it was back in Act Two. You can't go back to Act Two. Like, so I would say be a little liberal with it, you know, like just do it. You don't be so uptight about it like I was, just like trying to be so efficient with it.
Yeah. I think in Act One, I was like overflowing with camping supplies. And then in Act Three, I ran out like often. And I literally like stole food from tables and stuff like that to
get make ends meet.
Yeah. No, I bought food at food vendors in Act Three. Yeah, I know, right?
Dude, I think last time I checked in my in my bank, I had like 40 of the the 40 camp supply.
Oh Jesus.
Packages just sitting there, plus all the other food like sausages and wine and cheese and shit.
Yeah. No, it was like my party rolling up to the food vendor just being like, "Give me all of your finest sausages and cheese, sir." And then we take them off into the woods and go camping. Yeah.
That's awesome. I did hear though, there are some voice lines in the game where people are saying things like, "Oh, I'm so tired," or "I could use a rest," or like,
"Oh yeah,
like
they do." Yeah.
And so when you're not, you don't need it. Like, everyone's totally fine. But it just happens after you've played so long. So there was some rumor or something about like how Larian did have the idea to make people need to be hungry or need to sleep, having a sort of a different sort of like hunger meter or tire, like sleep meter or something like that, but maybe had taken it out just to make sure the game flowed a little better. I don't know if that's true, but it is an interesting thing that those voice lines are in there.
Yeah, I don't think this game would have benefited from having like a hunger meter or a sleep meter or something like that, but that it is interesting, maybe they were considering it. Yeah,
well, because it's interesting that you can take, you like when you do a long rest, you end the day doing long, you can choose how many supplies you would need to use, but why would you ever use anything less than 40?
Right,
was kind of my question.
Yeah, I guess like if I had less than 40, I just wouldn't long rest, so we would just leave camp instead of resting. So, yeah.
They double it on higher difficulty. You need 80.
Jesus.
But, yeah. I do like the camp aspect of it. Like, you have all these moments where you're out exploring the world, and then going back to camp and just talking to people, I thought was like a wonderful shakeup. It's kind of how you experience their stories. The camps differ, like in all the different environments, mm-hmm. the camp environment will be different and unique and very cool. I actually really liked that aspect of it. Oh, I'm going to go back to camp because I need to quickly talk to Gale about something.
Yeah. And characters in camp will like comment on what the last mission was. They'll comment on things that happened, like say like some really messed up thing happened to one of your characters. Like everyone in camp will be talking about it when you get back. And that's always really cool. Again, it makes it feel like you're a real group traveling together, and like the things that affect one person affect other people too. So that stuff is cool. One of the camps is really small, and I had this this bad situation. I had to reload. So Gale died during combat, and I brought him back to life, but he had this status effect called like, I don't know, like death stench or some shit like that. And it hurt everyone that was, you know, within a certain area near him. And there's a dog that you can get in camp, and the dog kept wandering over next to Gale, and he died because Gale smelled so bad. So Yeah, stuff can happen in camp. There's some like big story events that can happen in there too. So I spent a lot of time in camp, and it's worth your time, but sometimes we got to a point where it was like, I really want to continue with something, but I can't because I'm out of spell slots and I just need to rest. But yeah, so let's talk about the tactics of combat. Divinity Original Sin 1 and 2 were really great for environmental effects and setting up how important, like electrifying a puddle of water or setting the environment on fire and stuff like that would be. They also had high ground and low ground. So archers will be better if they're perched up on high ground than if they're shooting from below something, for example. And spells work that way too. So Baldur's Gate 3 brings that stuff in. Also keeps a big emphasis from those older games on status effects and turn denial. Every single enemy can have some kind of status effect, which is great. So putting together ways to stop the enemies from acting, get status effects on them, set the environment on fire if you want to, synergize your party member strategies, get these elemental effects going. You can set up like a really good order of operations with your party and then adjust to what the enemy does. And the tactical depth to all of this, like when you combine it all together, feels pretty much unlimited. And one thing that I think is cool about this too is I didn't play with anyone who felt bad in combat. It was like there wasn't anyone who I tried to use that just didn't feel like they could accomplish anything. Like everyone had a role to play in the tactics. So like the depth of all of this is like ridiculously good.
And don't be afraid to use your environment too. I mean, like there are barrels and things everywhere where it's like, all right, I'm going to knock this water barrel over, create a puddle. And then if I use ice on that, there's a whole sheet of ice that now the enemy has to walk across.
Yeah.
Very, very cool.
Or pushing people off of ledges into bottomless pits.
When all else fails, just throw them in there.
Yeah.
But careful. If you push someone off a ledge, you lose their loot. So
yes. I did that with someone who had a quest item one time because I didn't know they had the quest item. And it teleported the quest item back to the spot where they were standing. But otherwise, yeah.
Yeah, I was playing the Eldritch Blast Warlock, so I was blasting everything off of ledges and things like that very freely in the beginning parts of the game. But I remember killing a boss that way and learning later that they had, I don't remember what it was, some kind of item, that some piece of gear that I think would have been really good for me. But
yeah,
that sucks. Another thing, too, is you can't do this with every boss, but if you walk up to something and you know it's a boss, you can right-click it and examine it and see all of its resistances, its vulnerabilities. You can see a lot of those special abilities that it can do. And once I started doing that, pretty much all the encounters became much easier because I could set up my party in certain areas in the arena or in that battlefield in ways that would benefit me and kind of disadvantage that, rather than just like, just steamrolling into it and just like expecting to set up later. Sometimes you don't really have that opportunity.
Yeah. All of like the combat encounter areas are set up really interesting too. Like there's often like high ledges or edges that you can push people off of. Like, if you're inside, like you can probably climb up on like a ledge or up in the rafters and like enemies might follow you up there. And all the things that we've said, like that you can do to the enemies, pushing them off ledges or stuff like that, they can do that to you too. So right. I had to reload a couple of encounters where it's just like, nope, my main character got blasted off into the void. So we have to reload. Like the enemies feel smart enough, even on like the balanced mode, where there were very few fights that felt like total cakewalks. They all required some degree of strategy. And even the easy ones, because you don't get like a full heal after every combat, you still need to be efficient with it, because then if you don't, you have to use your short rests. And if you use up all your short rests, then you have to go do a long rest. And if you're in a dungeon, you can't long rest. So you do need to, like you said, Chris, try to be efficient with everything that you're doing. But like, I don't know. I was just constantly amazed by how quickly a lot of the fights turn into chaos. And then you have to adjust to what's going on. Use every tool in your tool belt to try and get out of them. Like there were some boss fights where it was like, you know, I used every scroll that I had, every single one that I thought I would never use. I had to use them. And I love games like that, that force you to use those items.
I just killed the boss before they could do anything. I had no problem with it.
No big deal. Yeah.
Just kidding. There was one boss fight that was actually very, very tough. I think you'd mentioned it earlier. I'm sure we're talking about the same one. We'll talk about it in spoilers, but yeah.
The amount of times in this game that I would set up a bunch of bomb barrels together only to have combat accidentally start and the enemy would just use the bomb barrels against me.
Yeah.
At least three times.
Yeah. And depending on who you have in your party, like your approach to a lot of fights will be very different if you're fighting them straight up. And then if you're not going to fight them straight up and you're going to try and do like the bomb barrel thing, like you just stack up a bunch of bombs because you know, like this thing's going to aggro at some point. So I'll just stack up these barrels here. When they do aggro, we'll hit it with some fire. It'll explode and we will profit and we'll move on. Like you can do a bunch of goofy shit like that too, on top of like the super strategic depth that all of your character spells and stuff has. So this game has 12 character classes and 46 subclasses in there. So all the possibilities that all of these things can do, and they all seem pretty viable to me in combat. So without any spoilers, let's just mention, like, what side characters did we like to use? Did we have any kind of, like, general strategies that we found to be really fun?
The one thing about this whole class and subclass thing is you can actually start to mix and match classes and subclasses, and some of them play together really, really well. So one of my favorites on my Lazel run, I used Karlach for the first time. And her as just a thrower, like just, I'm going to stand in the back and chuck the weapon at you. Yep. If you took her like barbarian and then also put her a little into rogue, she would get an additional bonus action. And so you could do four throws in a round and just start wiping the floor with people.
Literally picking people up and wiping the floor with them.
Yes, yeah, throwing people into other people or just off the edge. It's like, I don't want to deal with them. So that was always good. I have a soft spot in my heart for kind of like what is considered the traditional D&D party is a fighter, a cleric, a thief, and a wizard. And one of my runs was that. And I really like that because they all have their own very specific part to play. The fighter is just get in your face and do damage. The cleric is kind of hold the line and keep people going. The sneaky rogue boy is in the back sniping people. And then the wizard is just popping wall of fire and standing back. I really like stuff like that.
I didn't even know that was sort of the traditional role. That's, now that I think about it, that is exactly what my party was, essentially. I didn't have a wizard, but yeah, I had that traditional role, so that makes sense. Yeah, you have people like I didn't realize, I got into multiclassing kind of early on, and I was like, oh, this is really fun. And I had Lazel multiclassed as like a fighter cleric or something, because I thought it'd be cool to give her some of the divinity reactions. Or something like that. Mm-hmm. And then I read somewhere, I think I was just on Reddit, on the BG3 Reddit, and someone was saying something like, oh, what's the best fighter build? And then everyone was just like, oh, you should just put two levels into fighter, three levels into fighter, and then multi-class over to four more levels into fighter, and then finish off the rest in fighter. They're just like, just keep the whole thing fighter the entire time.
Yeah,
and so I was like, okay, yeah, maybe it is really good at higher levels to just do that. And then I realized, oh, she has like a third attack like that she can do. So at some point I was like using haste on her, so she would have like three actions at some times. And so it was like, that's nine swings of her sword. Like, it's insane. Do you know what I mean? Yeah, so she became kind of ridiculous, and Asterion kind of was this very similar, having 2 to 3 actions at any given time.
Yeah,
using haste or things like that. I think haste kind of it's a fun spell, but I feel like it kind of trivializes a lot of the content, if I'm being honest.
It's busted.
Yeah. So if you want a challenge, I think, don't they do that in the honor mode where you can't use it, or it's like nerfed?
It's the traditional way, which in this game, if you haste, you just get a full other action. So like, yeah, 3 attacks become 6 sort of thing. in real D&D, haste gives you 1 additional action, which you can use for 1 additional attack. So
I see. Not 3 for 10 attacks becomes
4. Well, it is. It lasts for a minute. A minute is considered 10 rounds, and well, because 1 round is like 6 seconds.
Interesting. Yeah, some of the interactions between those spells and certain classes, I think, yeah, if you're doing like 200 damage with a single character a turn, with like impunity, like there's no. Yeah, like each weapon swing is like a 96% chance to hit with advantage. You're like, okay,
yeah,
this stuff is getting a little too easy. Like,
yeah, with my party, I had, so my character was a druid. So I like druids because they could be big, strong melee fighters. If you turn into the bear, or later on, you can turn into a dinosaur and shit. So the druid was that, but the druid can also use a lot of magic. So depending on what the situation needed, the druid could kind of switch between those two roles. I had Shadowheart, who I respect to be more of a healing cleric. So Shadowheart was a healer, and then also a good mage if she needed to be. She had some really strong stuff. And then I had Lazel and Karlak both on the front line, just like a wood chipper, basically. They were just destroying everything. And then, yeah, Karlak had the ability to throw dead bodies. So Karlak would often kill a character, then pick up the dead body and throw it at another enemy, which would knock them down. So that was a lot of fun to do. And then later on in the game, I got an item that made Karlak giant. So she would just wreck shop. So that was my main party, was Karlak, Lazel, my druid, and then Shadowheart. And sometimes, especially if I was doing a side quest, I would get Will in there, or Gale. Not often Asterion, unless I really needed sneaky stuff outside of combat.
One of the ways that, as my evil playthrough that I played, and I don't suggest people play this because it bogs the game down so much, was essentially a full pet build. So I was a necromancer wizard, and when I was all topped up on all my undead I could have going at one time, I would have 10 undead under me. My frontliner was a character that we'll get into in the spoiler section, who was could also raise some undead. And then I would have a druid, who we'll get into in the spoiler section, who could have 11 summons of her own. And then I would just have Asterion blinking through all of this with double crossbows, just getting in people's faces and just blasting them. But it would bog the game down so much, because all of a sudden my turn, I had 20 things I had to move.
Yeah, yeah.
and it actually slowed the game down. I don't recommend people play it like that.
I think Aaron was supposed to be on this episode with us, and I think he played that way too. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. Just a little touch of the different combinations, strategies that you can play with in combat here. Like I said, like the depth to party composition, and then the depth to the skills and how you manage the situations in combat seems pretty limitless. And especially, I assume, once you're on like honor mode or something like that, that like your tactics have to be sound in order to make progress.
Yeah, I think there's even that one boss fight we mentioned earlier that you do get an ally. Well, there's a possibility that you can have an ally.
Yeah.
And if she wasn't there, honestly, I don't know how you couldn't really set your party up for this. You couldn't plan for it. There's nothing you could do. If she wasn't there, I definitely would have full party wiped and just,
same here.
Would have had a really, really hard time with that one. I think, we must be talking about the same one.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, there's a couple of those interactions that are just, they seem kind of broken. And there's also one thing that I've kind of mentioned since we're talking about combat. I don't know if you guys got used to like maybe clicking portraits when you were trying to attack something to attack it, but I don't know how many times I got so frustrated, especially with Asterion. I went in with like double hand crossbows. Mm-hmm. So I would have like a bunch of attacks that I would like need to click, click enemies on. And like if they were kind of like characters that had like kind of weird animations, they would like jump around a little bit or whatever. I would click the ground and I would attack. I would shoot an arrow at the ground next to them because they'd like jumped right at the moment I was clicking. Oh, that was so frustrating. So,
oh yeah, I bet.
Yeah. There's a couple of those like little things that are just kind of like how can you avoid that? Is this me being bad or is this bad design? Like, I don't know. Like,
Before I got super comfortable with the camera, if somebody would get mobbed, there was plenty of times where one of my guys would just attack another one of my own party members because I meant to click a bad guy. And it's like, oh, you just did like 30 damage to a guy I didn't need you to do that to.
Yeah, that feels bad. Yeah.
How wild is wild magic, by the way? I just like if you could just like on a scale of 1 to 10, because my next playthrough, I would like to have like a wild magic sorcerer just doing weird stuff.
I love that build. I haven't used it in this game. Knowing what I know about it, some pretty wild things can happen. And I don't know if they... So there's, I think, 50 different things. Because every time you cast a spell, there's a chance wild magic could happen. It rolls a d20. And then you roll a d100. And I think 50 different things can
it's
happen.
It's a big dice,
exactly. And I think
how do you tell what you rolled? Like, anyways.
Oh, so it's actually 2d10s that you roll, and one of them is your 10, and the other one's the 0 to 1.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
But like 50 different things can happen. Everything from your skin turns blue, you turn into a flower pot, to you cast fireball on yourself. So you can have some like TPKs on accident because everyone's grouped up, you're level 1, your cantrip goes wrong, fireball is cast on you, everybody's dead.
Yeah.
All right. That's fun. That's going to be a lot of fun, I think. So.
Yeah. I'm not sure how it works in the game, but it is a fun mechanic to have programmed in. I always liked using Metronome in Pokemon just to see what happens. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's roll into the wrap-up section and housekeeping before the spoiler section. We're already at 2 hours here. This might be the first episode that I actually have to split in 2 episodes and then release separately. I think that if someone has listened this far in the podcast and they don't already know the answer to this, then they weren't actually listening. But, guys, who would you recommend play Baldur's Gate 3? And if you have any wrap-up thoughts about it, here is the place for that, too.
So, I mean, it's probably the best game I've ever played. I do have some criticisms, but in all honesty, they are pedantic at absolute best. Act 1 is simply perfect. I think it should be taught in schools, like as part of a public education.
Yeah.
I'm on my 4th playthrough at the moment. I've dumped 500 hours into this game. I already am planning 2 more playthroughs currently.
Oh, Jesus.
I know it's a new game. Like it only has been out for 9-10 months now, but like ever since its release, it dominates my thoughts. I theory craft in my head. I think about the design choices in this game that are like incredible. From a D&D standpoint, I actually think it's a really cool campaign. It adds a lot to the world. It changes some of the lore, actually. Like they got the liberty to change some stuff which Wizards of the Coast is going to adopt. It's just absolutely incredible. I don't know if I have anything else to say about it. I recommend it to everyone. I think that, again, it needs to be played in schools.
Yeah, I honestly, these days, I think for a long time, honestly, I haven't really played a lot of single player game. I mean, this game has multiplayer too, but I haven't really played a lot of sort of single player adventure games in quite a while. I kind of got on the MMO train for a long time and doing like MOBAs and things like that. But there is every once in a while where there's a game that kind of piques my interest. That is a single player game. And this one, I'm really glad it did. I'm really glad I was pushed to buy it because I absolutely loved it. You know, putting down other games, putting down games like MMOs where you kind of do need to play a lot to be good, to just be like, sorry guys, like to my guild and friends, like I'm playing Baldur's Gate, like I don't know what to tell you, like I can't focus on raiding, I can't focus on these other things that I need to do for MMOs. I just, like you, can't stop thinking about what I'm going to do next in this game. Yeah. And like I mentioned before, I kind of put the game down for a while. It was just kind of due to real life stuff. I wasn't really playing any games at all. But yeah, now that I'm kind of back into it, thanks to Dave and getting me on this podcast, I'll probably be hooked again, being back on it. In terms of who I'd recommend it to, I would say, I mean, I think even if you don't like the idea of turn-based combat, but you do like a good story, I think that the turn-based combat in this game could grow on you for reasons that we discussed before, visuals, and because it is interesting, the interactions between everything. Yeah, I think if you don't really like story, things like that, maybe the game's not for you. But even then, like, you might be somebody who's really into this thing like theory crafting and things, being sort of a tactician, to use that word. To craft the battlefield the way that you want to. Yeah, it's going to be fun. I think you will enjoy it. I think it's definitely worth every penny that you'd pay for it. So yeah, I can't really think of anybody who I wouldn't recommend it to, unless you just don't like video games. But even then, I think a lot of people who don't like video games saw it, picked it up and tried it as their first video game and loved it. So
Yeah. It definitely did transcend like the types of games that people normally play. So I think I've heard and seen enough out there from people who I would normally say, like, well, if you don't like a D&D ass like RPG, then maybe don't play this. But this game has seemed to appeal to a lot of people that don't normally like a D&D ass RPG. So I think that, like, there's just such a quality across the board here that, like, if you are someone who really responds to like a branching story and characters and things like that, this game is excellent at that. And if you're someone who wants like really crunchy combat and mechanics to like sink your teeth into, this game has that too. And if you like, you know, a story with good presentation and acting and things like that, this game has that. Like, it really does have something that would appeal to lots of different types of people. So, like, if you really don't want to play a game like this, and you know yourself, then don't force yourself to play it, of course. But for everybody else, I do think there is something to appeal. And if you're someone who likes all of those things above, then you're going to end up like the three of us, just basically having nothing but good things to say about it. I do think this is one of the best games ever made. And I think I've said that about some other games on the podcast as I did the recording. And then as I look back a couple years later, I'm like, was that really one of the best games ever made? I'm not sure. But this is, and I will look back on this in like 5, 10, 20 years and be like, fuck, that was a really good game. What, like, how did they make this? So that's really what I'm going to take away. So it's an easy recommendation to anyone who thinks they might be interested in it. Let's do a little bit of housekeeping before spoiler time. So thank you for listening up until this point. Spoilers are going to begin soon, so you can hop out when the music break starts. But before you do that, please consider leaving a rating and review for this podcast on your favorite podcast app of choice. The podcast is also on YouTube. If you want to do YouTube things over there, liking, subscribing, and that whole deal, you can join the Discord server and come in and talk about your adventures in Baldur's Gate 3. If you missed when we had the special channel in the Discord server, hop on in now. Talk about your experiences. Listen through the spoiler section if you want to hear what happened in our playthroughs, and then come in and share what happened in yours. You can also support monetarily for as little as $2 per month on patreon.com/realDaveJackson, where you'll get to vote in polls for what games I do on the show. As this episode airs, there should be a new poll coming up in a week or so, beginning of May. And yeah, it's a good time. It helps helps me out with costs associated with running the podcast. Helped me pay for my trip to PAX East not too long ago. So that's really helpful. And last but not least, I have another show called A Top 3 Podcast, where we do top three lists, we do drafts, and things like that. That's a comedy show. It's a good time. And yeah, I think you'd enjoy that too. So with all that being said, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, it's full spoiler time for Baldur's Gate 3.
Lace your heart with mine. Let your sleeping soul take flight. Take me through the night. Down, down, down by the river. Down, down, down by the river.
Hey, hey, Dave here, back again, just to remind you, in case you forgot, that the spoiler section for Baldur's Gate 3 is contained in its own episode. You can go find it in the Tales from the Backlog feed. It is called Baldur's Gate 3 Spoiler Section. Same guests, same great conversation in its own episode, because I'm a parody of myself and this episode was just so big. So, I hope to see you there. Bye now.
By the river.